Kane lunged forward, but a numbing blow landed on the back of his head, delivered with savage accuracy and economy by a gold-armored Nephilim. A bomb seemed to go off in his skull, and he was dimly aware of falling. He tried to catch himself by his hands, but they didn't seem to be there anymore. He didn't lose consciousness, but he hovered at its brink for what seemed like a very long time. He tried to get up, but a boot sole slammed against his neck, mashing his face into the cold deck. Hands groped all over him, snatching away his war bag and his Sin Eater.
Get the fuck off of him!
Kane thought he heard Grant shouting something. The words were indistinct through the roaring waterfall in his head, but the tone was angry.
I do all of you a great honor, and you return it with disrespect. In the old days of my reign, very few of your race ever saw my true face and lived.
The pressure of the foot was removed, and Kane slowly pushed himself up to all fours. Two of the Nephilim stood on either side of Grant, asps pointed at his head. His Sin Eater was missing from his right forearm. Bridget had been forced to her knees by Enlil, his hand still tangled in her hair, wrenching her head back at a brutal angle. Although her eyes were squeezed shut against the pain, she made no outcry, nor did she try to wrest away the Overlord's fingers. Kane's rage was somewhat cooled by the blood freezing in his veins. The spectacle of the concentrated satanic fury blazing in Enlil's eyes drove all thoughts of violence from his mind.
Do you think I care anything for humanity? You were the slaves of my race, and we were your gods. You will worship us as your gods again, and you will gladly be our tools to rebuild the empire of the Anunnaki.
As Kane climbed back to his feet, Enlil released Bridget with a forceful flourish, and she fell heavily onto her right side. She began to push herself up to her hands and knees, but Enlil planted a foot between her shoulder blades and slammed her down to the deck again.
As we are restored, humanity is now returned to its rightful place, crawling on their bellies at our feet.
As if playing to the crowd, Enlil kept his foot on Brigid and spread his arms wide.
And you apelings who defied my race and me, you were justly punished for your arrogance. You have been reduced to the ape again by your own savage impulses. And now the Anunnaki are ascendant once more.
He turned, thrusting both arms toward the view screens and the glittering pinpoints of light dotting the land masses and oceans.
We will seek out the sites of our own cities, of our ancient ports and vaults. Oceans and barbarian tribes might have swept over them, and some lie beneath barren deserts. But we will uncover them, resurrect them, bring them forth into the dawning of this new age.
A green-armored Nephilim opened the war bags and dumped their contents onto the floor. A scattering of ammo clips, gas grenades, transcom units, batteries, blocks of plastic explosive, flashlights, and the little electronic lock decryptors called Nemesines. Enlil peered over at the items, amused, and lifted his foot from Bridget.
Rise.
Face not showing her anger or humiliation, Bridget carefully climbed to her feet. She joined Kane and Grant, unconsciously stepping between the two men to stand shoulder to shoulder.
Is there any point in asking why you would do such things instead of starting fresh?
You still do not fully understand, do you? None of you. We created human culture on Earth. All of your languages, your arts, your aspirations, all derived from Nibiru, myself, these overlords before you. We did it. It was by our hands that we raised your barbaric race from the mire of apedom. You advanced far and quickly, and then turned treacherously upon those who ruled the world.
All that men know or have ever known is like a grain of sand beside a mountain compared to our knowledge, our science. Our hands lifted you from the muck, and those same hands will cast you down into a hell far more horrifying than your holy men ever envisioned.
Enlil showed the edges of his teeth in a cold, taunting grin. He swept a hand toward the multi-tiered edifice.
All during the rise of your planet's civilizations, humanity's ancient masters slept there, slumbering through the lost ages as mere minutes, awaiting the day of final awakening. There were some among your kind, special ones whom we anointed either with our blood or our dreams, who foresaw the day when your own self-hatred would scorch clean the face of the world and make ready for our return.
Kane's stomach muscles fluttered in adrenaline-fueled spasms. He struggled to tamp down the insane fury flooding through him, clouding his reason. During his encounters with the Thrush entity, he had found it difficult to hate a creature who didn't truly live. It was only during his final confrontation with Thrush on the third parallel casement that he realized the absolutely soul-deep hatred he felt toward the being. He saw him not as a man, but as what he really was, an ancient evil thing that crept among the primordial grasses, apart from human life, but watching it with eyes of cold wisdom, offering a silent laugh of superiority, giving away nothing but bitterness. He had the name of a bird and the appearance of a man, but his brain was that of a serpent. Kane had been overwhelmed with a hate-fueled rage to crush what passed for life out of him. Intermittently, over the past 2 years, Kane had jerked awake from slumber, sweat-drenched and shaking, as his sleeping mind dredged up with terrifying clarity the words Thrush had once psionically impressed into his memory. "You will know my presence in your own casement soon enough. By then, I hope you will have resigned yourself to what cannot be changed. Do not fight anymore. There is no use in it." He understood now that on a visceral, subliminal level, he had always realized the Thrush entity was something far worse, far more ancient and evil than a hybrid blending of machine, human, and Anunnaki genetic material.
"Do any of these special ones still exist? Can you exert control over every creature that shares Anunnaki genes?"
Kane's throat constricted as he grasped the ugly implications of her question. Years before, the preserved body of Enlil had been in the possession of the self-appointed ruler of Britain, a man calling himself Lord Strongbow. All of them had seen the corpse in Strongbow's fortress in New London. Strongbow had admitted to using Enlil's genetic material to mutagenically modify himself and his shock troops, the Imperial Dragoons. Furthermore, he had arranged the creation of a hybrid mixture of three races, human, Tuatha De Danann, and Anunnaki. Enlil died after impregnating a young woman who carried Danann blood. Lord Strongbow had made arrangements for both himself and the pregnant woman to be placed in cryonic suspension for nearly a century and a half. They had revived nearly 30 years before, but the woman escaped from Strongbow to Ireland and gave birth to an infant possessing the mixed blood of all three races. The hybrid infant had grown into the beautiful demigoddess Sister Fand, whom he, Grant, and Bridget had encountered on a couple of occasions. She had been instrumental in overthrowing Strongbow's Imperium Britannia. He wondered if the resurrected Enlil remembered the last act of his former incarnation, and if even now he influenced Fand and the remnants of the Dragoons from orbit. Kane managed to keep the relief surging through him from showing on his face when Enlil answered Bridget's question.
"That would be quite impossible. The Nephilim are a different matter since they were specifically engineered to be linked with Tiamat and the Overlords. As is the girl child that the female Quavel will soon bring into the world."
"How do you know it's a girl child?"
Enlil tapped his forehead with his index finger.
"I have always enjoyed a special rapport with my wife, Ninlil."
"Yes, Ninlil. The female with whom your reputation as a rapist was cemented. If I recall the legend correctly, you followed her to the banks of the Id-Nunbirtum River, where she often went to bathe. It was there you attacked her and impregnated her."
"You recall the legend accurately, but it is only a legend, not quite the truth, nor yet a complete falsehood."
Kane felt as if he were trying to fight his way out of a bad dream. He stopped short of shaking his head.
"How could Quavel possibly give birth to your wife?"
"She's not. She is giving birth to what you might call a blank slate, a tabula rasa, an empty vessel waiting to be filled. Although she carries the Anunnaki genetic profile, the child is in an intermediate form of development. Certain segments of her DNA, strands of her genetic material, can be encoded after the fact."
With his right hand, he made a flourishing gesture, like a conjurer performing a card trick, and a tablet of destiny glinted between his thumb and forefinger.
She will be brought here to be properly imprinted, both mentally and biologically. Her tablet will be downloaded, and then the Supreme Council will be complete. After that, Tiamat will prepare to give birth, rebirth, to the entire Anunnaki pantheon.
Maybe that can be done, and maybe it can't. Either way, won't you be taking the concept of cradle-robbing to a whole new level? Unless you plan to wait until she comes of age, and I don't see you as a particularly patient snake face.
If we can extend our lives through genetic manipulation, doesn't that suggest we can affect changes upon the aging process?
Grant did not answer, but Kane recalled how months earlier, DeFore expressed concern over the irregularities in the genetic sequencing of Quavel's fetus. Her fears that the condition might result in either a birth defect or a miscarriage now seemed almost laughable.
How do you plan to get the baby up here for the treatment?
We'll go and fetch her, what do you think? Personally, I've waited long enough to get a look at that mountaintop rattle of yours.
Do you honestly think the people in Cerberus will turn her over to you just like that?
Kane. If there is one thing I am sure about your race, when faced with certain annihilation, you'll turn over anything, even your sense of self and identity, just so you can draw breath for one more day. Regardless of a superficial devotion to ideals, humankind are the ultimate pragmatists when the issues are your own lives or deaths.
Even in a new form, you allow the same old blinding arrogance, the same overweening hubris to motivate your actions. I had hoped it might be otherwise.
Enlil and the Overlord swung their heads up and around, goggling in shock toward the metal-walled structure rising from the deck. Balaam stood on the middle tier, some 50 feet above them, staring down with obsidian-eyed impassivity.
Balaam! Naga'ah! Me'am Namkar! Nam Siligum! Kuga'am! Za'ib Gim Orbarul!
I beg to differ. The final destiny of the human race is not out of their reach. But if you are not opposed, humanity will slide back, degenerate into a condition far worse than its pre-flood state of slavery. You would work toward debasing an intelligent species to the level of animals that will scrabble and fight to survive at your whim. I will not help you in such an endeavor. My blood flows with human and Anunnaki qualities, true enough. Far too long have I allowed myself to be guided by my Anunnaki heritage. It ends today, this very moment.
What have you done?
I had assumed you would have guessed. I've opened an interface to the database and have singled out one mental signature in the neural net. I imagine you can guess the identity of that signature.
Enlil's reaction was swift and violent. He whirled toward the Nephilim, standing guard around Kane, Bridget, and Grant.
C-O-O!
Sparks flared and the asp emitters trained on the trio. Bridget Baptiste exploded into motion, whipping her right arm up and around, balancing herself on the balls of her feet. A short, thick metal cylinder extended from her fist. A stream of white liquid sprayed from it, splashing against the unprotected faces of two of the Nephilim. They didn't cry out, but the neurotoxin triggered almost instant convulsions. Both Grant and Kane recognized the canister and the effects of the nerve toxin it dispensed. The chemical was absorbed through the pores of the skin and disrupted the central nervous system for a short time. Grant had thought to bring the spray in his war bag, but neither he nor Kane had seen Bridget palm it. Kane moved with the eye-blurring speed and explosion of near-superhuman reflexes that had made him something of a legend in the Cobaltville Magistrate Division. Hurling himself forward, he shoulder-rolled between the pair of spasming Nephilim and snatched up his sin-eater from the floor. As he rolled back up on the balls of his feet, he turned to see three Nephilim rushing to surround him and his friends. The sin-eater popped free of the holster into his hand. The first two shots struck a yellow-armored Nephilim full in his expressionless face, turning his features into a red-jelly smear. Pointing his pistol in the direction of the Overlords, he continued firing, keeping the trigger pressed down. The subsonic 9mm rounds ripped through the air, ricocheting off consoles with flares of blue sparks. The Overlords took cover behind their chairs, even though no rounds came very close to them. Kane scooped up Grant's pistol and tossed it to him. Grant fired a 3-round burst as soon as the weapon was out of the holster and in his hand, bowling a Nephilim off his feet.
Zivugu!
An asp bolt, fired by a purple-armored man, scorched the air very close to Grant's face.
Come here, asshole.
He grabbed one of the disabled Nephilim, grappling with him, using him as a shield. It was like wrestling with a human-sized dummy filled with molten lead, his arms hanging slack, his legs rubbery. An asp blast struck him square in the chest, the energy interacting violently with the alloy of the armor. Sparks showered in an eye-hurting display of pyrotechnics, and the kinetic force sent Grant staggering backward several feet. Pain shivered through him. He would have fallen if not for one of the black pillars at his back. Brigid raced toward the metal ziggurat, using the pylons as cover.
This way!
Grant dropped the dead man, the smoke pouring from his slagged breastplate burning his nostrils. He and Kane followed Brigid. Grant brought up the rear, snapping off a few shots to discourage pursuit. There was no answering fire. They wended their way among the dark pylons. Brigid reached the foot of the metal staircase that led up to the different tiers. The three of them sprinted up the stairs, two steps at a time. The stairway wound around the tower, hugging the lines of the exterior. When they reached the catwalk that composed the first tier, they paused to catch their breaths. Kane crouched, peering at the deck through the pillars.
Swift move, Baptiste. I didn't even see you reach for the nerve spray, much less grab it.
I was counting on all eyes being on Enlil as he strutted his stuff.
No one seems to be following us.
I'm not surprised. According to Balaam, this is the main memory nexus of Tiamat. All those pipes supply the synthetic equivalent of blood and cerebral spinal fluid to it. Not even an egoist like Enlil would want to risk damaging it. Her. Not to mention, there might be some pretty deadly self-defense systems built into it. Her.
Then why are we climbing around it, her?
We aren't threatening her, yet.
Kane looked up, shading his eyes from the glare cast by the battery of ceiling lights.
Balaam, do you want us to come to you or what?
Join me on the third level, with alacrity, if you please. I fear that Enlil knows my intentions and is taking action to stop me.
The Cerberus warriors started climbing again, bounding from step to step. Kane assumed the point man's position, alternating his attention from what lay ahead to the activities below. He caught only glimpses of armored figures flitting among the black columns surrounding the ziggurat.
I don't think we're being followed.
Kane didn't reply, too occupied with maintaining a steady run-leap-run gait. When the risers ended abruptly on a ledge, he nearly pitched headlong over the rail, trying to avoid a collision with Balaam.
Whoa!
The Archon stood before a small computer terminal. At least, winded Kane assumed it was a computer terminal. Instead of a conventional monitor screen, a series of crystals rose from within a glass-walled box. Several were shards much like smaller versions of the Starfire, and others were sculpted cylinders, prisms, and geometric shapes. A semi-transparent crystal in the shape of a life-sized grinning skull rose above the rest. Balaam's long bony fingers manipulated tiny colored tiles over a flat surface that reminded Kane of a chessboard. He slid the tiles from one section of the board to the other, and the crystals shimmered with different colors.
You're not playing the Anunnaki version of chess, I hope.
Balaam didn't answer for a moment, intent on manipulating the little squares.
After a fashion, I am indeed. What I am doing is complicated, but the closest analog in your frame of reference would be that I am attempting to infect Tiamat's data storage banks with a virus. Or to be more precise, convince a specific neural pattern within the database to act as one.
Kane and Grant only blinked at him. The two men were moderately familiar with computers. To them, they were simply sometimes useful machines, and their more arcane workings held little interest. Besides, there were plenty of people in the redoubt to perform the comp work if they needed it. Brigid stepped close to Balaam, her enthralled gaze passing over the sculpted crystals, and Balaam's long fingers moving the tiles this way and that.
This is a direct interface with Tiamat's database?
Yes. I am circumventing her internal main memory core and entering through a back door. To once again employ your vernacular.
Why?
Do you know what a computer virus is or what it does?
To be frank, I don't, and I don't give a shit either.
You might give a shit about this one. A computer virus in the form of a hidden code infects a database. It can wipe out whole megafiles of memory. The main memory core is responsible in some way for the operation of virtually every other system of this vessel.
So it's like giving the machine a lobotomy?
If that description helps you to visualize it, then yes, it's like giving the machine a lobotomy.
But you said you were trying to convince a certain neural pattern to act as a virus.
So I did, and that pattern belongs to Enki.
Enlil's half-brother? Why?
I think I know, and it makes perfect sense.
From the photosensitive plate of her eidetic memory, Brigid retrieved the exchange among herself, Brewster Filboid, and Enki in the Lunar Citadel nearly 6 months before. The last living, full-blooded Anunnaki had told them how his people had factionalized violently over the issue of humankind's fate. The decision was reached to go along with Enlil's plan to drown humanity, return to Nibiru, and then return to Earth after an appropriate period of time. Although Enki took covert steps to ensure there would be human survivors of the catastrophe, he had no choice but to leave Earth with the rest of his brethren. Enki and a small group of supporters had become attached to Earth and its inhabitants and were overwhelmed with guilt and remorse. Over the course of centuries on Earth, the perceptions of these few Anunnaki about life had changed. They had stopped seeking power and even knowledge and found themselves driven by a motivation grander than the simple survival of their race, a motivation to aid the development and fulfillment of all sentient life. This epiphany was what Enlil could not accept.
What makes perfect sense? And more importantly, why?
I get it. Balam is trying to single Enki's consciousness out of all the pantheon that have been digitized and stored. He'll convince him to interfere with whatever Enlil programs this ship to do.
You are essentially correct, but it is not as easy as your facile description makes it sound. The sum total of data in Tiamat's memory tanks is so vast that even the index is beyond the capacity of your lifespan to read.
Oh.
Trying to isolate Enki's specific signature among all the interconnected pathways is tantamount to isolating a specific grain of sand with a certain silicon content in the Sahara.
Oh, have you ever done anything like this before?
Never. Nor have I ever heard of it being attempted, much less accomplished. Brigid Baptiste gave me the idea when she inquired as to the self-aware states of the minds within the neural matrix. Unfortunately, I do not know if I am even on the proper track, or if I am, whether I can succeed in convincing Enki and those of his faction to act as viruses.
What's with the one shaped like a skull?
It would correspond to a memory buffer in one of our computers. Crystal skulls turned up at various archaeological sites during the 19th and 20th centuries. There are legends that indigenous peoples have crystal skulls that they keep secretly hidden from the rest of the world.
Why?
They supposedly contain encoded information. The public first became aware of the crystal skulls during the latter part of the 19th century. At that time, many museums of the world became interested in displaying antiquities from past civilizations. Egypt, Greece, Mesoamerica. By the 1870s, the Museum of Man in Paris and the Museum of Man in London each had a clear quartz crystal skull on display.
Where'd they come from?
Both were discovered in the 1860s, during the French occupation of Mexico, purportedly found in Mayan sites.
So the crystal skulls found there are the same thing as an Anunnaki computer's memory buffer?
Suddenly, Balam slapped the colored tiles with a frustrated flourish.
It is of no use. I do not know if Enlil is at another interface disrupting my efforts, or if my plan simply could not be implemented.
Do you usually give up this easy?
Brigid stepped forward to stand beside Balam. She opened the seals at the sleeves of her shadow suit and peeled back her gloves. Barehanded, she reached for the tiles.
Let me try.
Although your abilities are intriguing, as is your font of knowledge, you do not have the skills nor the necessary mind energy signature to perform this function. As I informed you, Tiamat is a living ship, a blending of organic and inorganic. Her organic elements are, of course, derived from the DNA of the royal family. In order to even access the computer core, much less interact with it, Tiamat will need to recognize both your genetic code and your EEG pattern.
Brigid's fingers began sliding the tiles around the board, tentatively at first, gauging the reaction her movements received from the crystal sculptures. They flashed with different hues and tones.
Did you not hear me?
I heard you fine. There's nothing to lose by my trying. Like you said, you're not omnipotent.
Kane peered over the railing down into the bridge below. He saw none of the overlords or the Nephilim, but he wasn't comforted. Grant eyed the metal wall of the ziggurat speculatively.
Is there some reason we don't do this the old-fashioned way?
As in?
Grant tapped the exterior with the barrel of his sin-eater and raised an eyebrow meaningfully.
If the objective is to take out the brain of this thing, why not just shoot it or find a way to pull the plug?
No, impossible.
Why?
Tiamat is sentient, even if she does obey a set of programs.
She also presents a very clear threat to Earth.
She cannot be held responsible for that. You can no more hold her personally responsible for what destruction she may wreak than you can blame a hurricane or an earthquake.
Even forces of nature have countermeasures taken against them.
If Balam had a reply, it was lost as the crystals took center stage. Whirls and waves of color passed through them, swirling the most intensely within the skull.
Whoa!
What have you done?
Rigid resumed sliding the tiles around, but this time with far more assured motions.
You said Tiamat would need to recognize my genetic and EEG signature, but I wasn't trying to make her acquaintance.
I still don't understand.
You never met Enki, did you?
No.
Well, I have. It was recognition from him I was trying to elicit, and I think I've succeeded.
Balam came as close to gaping in astonishment as it was possible for the structure of his features to allow. The skull began to emit a complicated series of signals, and Bridget Baptiste removed her fingers from the tiles.
Hello, Enki.
Balam placed his fingers on the tiles, but didn't manipulate them. The colors shifting through the crystal skull cast multi-hued highlights over his pale face. His huge black eyes reflected them like miniature rainbows. He gazed intently at the crystals for a long, silent moment, then peered up at Bridget.
It is Enki. I must confess I don't quite understand how you manage this.
Yeah, well, I must confess I don't quite understand any of this.
The way I figured it is that those little tiles are sensors that read your DNA and EEG signature. If they're on file in the database, you can access the memory banks.
Yeah, but why would your DNA and EEG codes be on file in an Anunnaki computer system?
They're not. If Balam had the interface set for standard network access, nothing would have happened. I would not have been able to evoke any kind of response at all. But as he said, he was entering the system through a back door, and that door bypassed all of Tiamat's security lockouts and led to a direct link with the mind energy of the Pantheon and the Matrix.
From what you're saying, it sounds like you basically just yelled, "Hey, Enki," in a crowded room and hoped he'd hear you.
That's about the cyber equivalent. If Enki is only one tiny facet of Tiamat's colossal data storage capacity, then trying to reach him through a conventional access process is futile. I guessed that most of Tiamat's memory is based on the MO model.
The what?
Memory of experience. Whatever Tiamat has experienced in her long existence, she remembers without it having to be specifically downloaded into her. I'm sure the same applies for her component subroutine modules, if they still possess any degree of independent data processing and function.
Enki has no memory of me, but he has one of you.
And therefore he responded. I don't know if I can interact with him through this terminal, but at least he's acknowledged me. Or I think he has.
Enki recognized your unique imprint. He does indeed remember you and is exceptionally curious about your presence.
You'll explain it to him, won't you?
Why can't you do it directly, Baptiste?
As biologically similar as we and the Anunnaki are in most ways, the synaptic structures of our brains differ considerably. But Balam's people, the Archons, are probably identical.
The differences are negligible. Our minds are in communication.
Balam slid the tiles swiftly to and fro, his expression and body language conveying complete concentration. Bridget glanced over the guardrail, then met Kane's and Grant's questioning looks with raised eyebrows.
I'm only guessing, but I think whatever Enlil was trying to pull with Tiamat's system has just been stymied by Enki.
The array of overhead lights suddenly flickered, dimmed, and then began strobing in a strange sequence. Balam paid no attention, his long fingers sliding the tiles purposefully into positions on the board.
I wish I knew if what's happening to those lights is good or bad.
Static hissed in their heads, as well as the beeping signal that indicated the contact channels were open.
Hear that? Good, I'd say. Enki has closed the dampening umbrella so our comms can function again.
Suddenly, the catwalk shuddered beneath their feet, and all of them experienced, for only a fraction of an instant, a lifting sensation in their stomachs as if they were floating upward.
Hey!
The synthetic gravity field fluctuated. Enki and maybe other minds of his former faction are affecting Tiamat's internal systems.
Grant clutched the handrail just in case gravity disappeared altogether.
Why?
Balam turned away from the terminal to address all of them.
To prove to Enlil and the overlords what they can do. I have communicated to Enki all that I know of Enlil's intentions and how he will most probably use Tiamat to further them.
So? He'll stop them?
That he cannot do. Enki may be a part of Tiamat, but only a small part. A fraction of a fraction of her overall systems. Yes, he can perform a few functions that are similar to a computer virus, but the effect is only temporary and impacts only on a few of her subroutines that have yet to be brought completely online.
So what the hell can he do? Annoy the overlords by playing with the light switches?
At the moment, the action he takes may save our lives. Enlil does not know the extent of Enki's interference with Tiamat's central computer core. As far as he knows, Enki could have reprogrammed her self-destruct code, and she is even now counting down to detonation.
Enki is just bluffing, right?
Precisely.
Balam! Akka is the Ick!
Excuse me, I believe he's screaming at me.
Yes, it is my doing! I have informed Enki of your plans. Much as it was thousands of years ago, he finds fault with them.
Is this Sa'abar'al?
Speaking the English.
Say, Enki has taken control of the critical environmental systems.
And the weapons.
Balam glanced over at Bridget and squeezed one eye shut in a conspiratorial wink.
How long do you think he can maintain this kind of interdiction? Not very long, I can promise you. I will turn every program, every function of every shipboard system against him and whoever else is aiding and abetting him.
Of that I have no doubt. But by the time you are able to implement such action, the damage he has wreaked may very well be incalculable, irreparable. Tiamat will be rendered uninhabitable for an indeterminate length of time. More than likely, a great deal of reprogramming of basic functions will be necessitated. Your reign will be over before it begins.
You will dare to do this to Tiamat?
She is not my mother.
Cain was so startled he nearly burst into a peal of laughter, but he repressed it, exchanging grins with Grant and Bridget.
What do you want?
Safe passage for my friends. Allow them to leave unmolested.
You too, Balam. We installed jump seats and auxiliary life support gear in the Mantas. They can carry one passenger apiece. You don't need to stay behind.
I will leave with them via their transatmospheric craft.
Their transatmospheric craft. I agree under one condition. You will permit me to access the terminal that you used to interface with Enki. That way, I may begin the process of undoing the damage.
Balam eyed his three companions questioningly.
I am uncomfortable with granting him that condition.
So am I. It could take him only seconds to find out that Enki's effects on the systems are superficial and activate a general override.
Well,
let's agree to it. Under a condition of our own. Which is what? I'll stay behind to make sure Enlil doesn't touch the interface until at least two of you have launched.
Balam's slit of mouth compressed as if he tasted something sour.
I am qualified to pilot the craft. I suggest Grant return to Earth with Bridget Baptiste. I will wait for you, Cain, in the other ship.
Both Bridget and Grant opened their mouths to protest, but Cain seized the moment.
Enlil, we accept your condition if you agree to one of ours. I'll hang with you up here until my friends are safely away. Once they are, you can have carte blanche to undo what Enki has done.
For a long, tense tick of time, they heard nothing.
Agreed.
Clear the bridge and the way to the hangar of all unsightly finheads and white eyes.
Agreed. Nephilim, Super Ugo, get in him, Uri. Utu, get in Uri. I have met your terms. It is time to abide by mine.
Come on up.
After a few minutes, Enlil strode onto the tier, eyeing them all with a cold loathing and disdain. He waved sharply, dismissively, with the ring-glittering fingers of his right hand.
You may go now. Deuteri will give my brethren the chance to change their minds. Not all of them agree with allowing you to escape. Only the concern for Tiamat's well-being stays their hands.
Isn't she immortal? How could we Apekin possibly hurt her?
She exists. She exists just as the fathomless void of space of the universe exists. She can no more die than the universe can perish. She but dreams, asleep above the surface of Earth, but still strong, potent, dangerous, and very, very real. Now be off, before she takes notice and decides to keep you here in her belly.
Bridget and Grant hesitated for a moment, but Kane hefted his sin-eater suggestively.
If he misbehaves, we'll find out how bulletproof that new hide of his might be at point-blank range.
Hell, that's almost worth staying around to see.
Vala, you are repeating and perpetuating the same tragic error in judgment of your forebears. We forgave your folk's treachery once before. We will not do so a second time.
I trust that you are aware of the reverse.
Balam, Grant, and Bridget walked past Enlil to the stairway. Bridget paused and tapped the contact behind her ear.
We'll let you know when we're aboard.
I'll be along directly.
Grant touched his right index finger to his nose and snapped it away in the wry 1% salute. It was a private gesture he and Kane had developed during their years as hard contact magistrates and reserved for high-risk undertakings with small ratios of success. Their half-serious belief was that 99% of situations that went awry could be predicted and compensated for in advance, but there was always a 1% margin of error, and playing against that percentage could have lethal consequences. Kane returned the salute gravely. Enlil folded his arms over his chest and regarded Kane with a predatory smile. Kane responded with a wintry one of his own, crossing his arms over his chest, resting the barrel of the Sin-Eater on the crook of his left elbow, the boar more or less aligned with the Overlord's head.
Balam's people became weakened by their time among you, Apekin. I had hoped that he would have recognized the inherent catastrophic consequences of championing your kind as his father had done. Now he will die with you. It is a tragedy. The last of his kind, dying among savages.
Seems to me that some of your own kind championed the cause of us, Apekin. That's sort of the reason you and I are even standing here right now.
They did not see you as the rest of us did.
As apelings?
Worse. As animals who love to kill one another, to make your brother and sister apelings suffer. You are happiest when covered with the blood of your own kind.
Yeah, I've heard that one before. Just like I've heard about all the wars you superior snake faces waged among yourselves. I can't disagree that humanity seems to have a taste for violence and bloodshed, but the funny thing is, whenever you start going back through history, looking for the source of humans warring on humans, there always seems to be a superior acting snake face at the bottom of it. Lots of different names in different places and times, but the M.O. is always the same.
We merely channel your inborn natural aggression and taste for blood, so you would thin your own herd. The least amount of bother to us. And of course, war is a sometimes beneficial commodity. Engendering it is an effective tool for maintaining control over an unstable population.
Yeah, you took a personal hand with that tactic from what I've heard. Samyaza, Asmodeus, Thrush, and God knows how many other aliases. You never could get it right, could you? You always underestimated the apelings.
Actually, we always found your behaviors and attitudes very predictable.
Enlil's silky tone of menace raised Kane's nape hairs, but he maintained a neutral expression.
For example, Did you honestly believe that I would allow you, Balaam, and your two friends to get off this ship alive?
Kane's head suddenly filled with a surge of static. His shoulders stiffened.
The dampening field is now back online due to the efforts of Lord Utu. A self-indulgent voluptuary he may be, but he is also gifted in all things electronic.
He reached out for the colored tiles on the board, and Kane leveled the Sin Eater on a direct line with his head. Enlil regarded him with an emotion akin to pity.
You already know how ineffectual your weapon is against me, Kane. The projectiles certainly hurt, but they can't kill me. Certainly not before I pluck out both your eyes and stuff them in your mouth. You may recall the counsel I offered you before, when I wore a different face and different name. Resign yourself to what cannot be changed. Do not fight anymore. There is no use.
I remember. And I also remember how I took that advice to heart.
Swinging the Sin Eater toward the terminal, he depressed the trigger stud, firing through all the rounds remaining in the magazine in one long, stuttering roar. Bright brass arcing from the ejector port mixed with flying splinters of crystal, the translucent skull dissolved in a spray of glittering fragments. When the firing pin struck the empty chamber, Kane matter-of-factly returned the pistol to its holster and met Enlil's shocked gaze with an unemotional one of his own.
Sort of like that, as I recall.
The sudden squall of static from the contacts distracted Grant and Bridget Baptiste long enough for the pair of Nephilim to get the drop on them. Bridget had taken only a few steps into the corridor leading to the hangar bay when the gray-armored man lunged from an open doorway and snatched her up in his arms, using her as a shield against Grant. The big man was too occupied with fending off a Nephilim in red armor. He body-blocked Grant, driving him backward, reaching out for a scuttling Balaam at the same time. Raising her boot, Bridget stamped down hard on her captor's instep, raking the edge of her heel down his shin. It was a move she'd learned from Grant and Kane, but it was completely futile due to his alloy-shod limbs. Her next tactic was to butt the Nephilim with the back of her head. The move was marginally more effective. The man loosened his grip. Taking advantage of the shift in his weight, Bridget secured a tight, double-handed hold on his right arm and bent it forward, slamming her rear end into his lower belly. She put all of her strength in the move. The man came over her back, and she maintained the grip on his forearm as she dropped him to the deck, bringing him down with a loud clatter. Without hesitation, Bridget kicked him in the temple as hard as she could. He started trying to claw his way up from the floor. She kicked him in the face, splitting his lower lip, then again in the temple. The toe of her boot ripped away the filaments extending from the half-helmet into his flesh. Little pinpoints of crimson bloomed on his skin, and the man stopped moving, frozen in place, his mouth half open, blood trickling from his lacerated lip. Staring at him nonplussed, Bridget carefully released her hold on his arm and stepped back. The Nephilim didn't move. He remained in the semi-prone position, arm raised as if reaching for something. At the same time, Grant opened up with his Sin Eater against the red-armored Nephilim who was intent on capturing Balaam. The echoes of the Sin Eater's fusillade rolled and rang as Grant marched forward, arm extended straight out, the pistol at the end of it spitting fire and lead. The Nephilim careened away from the 9mm barrage, body jerking and twitching under the multiple impacts against his armor-encased torso. Heels catching on the edge of the raised floor, he fell unceremoniously onto his back, legs kicking furiously. But he managed to fire one last ass blast. The bolt of flaming energy brushed the barrel of Grant's Sin Eater. For an instant, the gun was enclosed within a cocoon of blinding energy. The cocoon burst, and the Sin Eater exploded with it. Grant staggered the width of the corridor and fell heavily against the opposite wall. Both Bridget and Balaam rushed to him. Lips compressed tightly, Grant gripped his right wrist with his left hand. A halo of smoke surrounded what was left of his Sin Eater. His gloved hand still gripped the butt, but the rest of the pistol was gone, blasted away by the proton plasma. Little blobs of semi-slagged steel clung to the sleeve of his shadow suit. He worked at the tabs and strap of the holster, finally just ripping it away and letting it drop to smolder on the deck. Bridget reached out for his hand, but Grant pulled away. She grabbed him by the bicep.
Let me look at it.
There's nothing to see.
Experimentally, he flexed his fingers. They stirred feebly. They were numb, feeling as large as cucumbers.
I'm all right, I think.
Balaam regarded him searchingly, then gingerly touched his hand with one long finger, tracing a line from the knuckles to the wrist.
No serious damage, If not for your glove, you could have easily lost your hand.
Yeah, well, it feels like I have already. I hope I can still pilot us out of here.
That may not be an option now. The dampening umbrella is open again. I don't know if that means control of the computer has been taken back from Enki, or if Kane is...
Balam narrowed his big eyes and turned his head this way and that, like a foxhound casting for a scent on the wind.
He is not dead, but his thoughts are a chaotic jumble, far more extreme than is usual for him.
Is he in trouble?
I believe so.
Grant stepped over to the Nephilim, frozen on the ground, and gingerly prodded him with the toe of his boot. The man fell over, his arms and legs barely moving, as if he were a mannequin that had somehow dropped on the floor.
What the hell is going on here? He's paralyzed or something.
Balam gestured to the filaments hanging like loose threads from the underside of the helmet.
The control circuit was interrupted.
You mean the Nephilim don't possess the means for independent thought?
That would depend greatly on what overlord they serve. This one belongs to Lord Nergal.
Is there another access terminal anywhere nearby?
Balam surveyed the corridor, then started off quickly toward the double doors at the end of the passage.
Logic suggests there should be one right outside the launch bay.
Grant and Bridget started off after him. Grant still cradled his injured hand.
Why do you say that?
Anunnaki engineers were notoriously efficient about designing redundancies into their systems. If for some reason the hangar deck could not be depressurized, or the exterior airlock doors open or closed, a direct data feed to the appropriate control mechanism would overcome a number of problems.
On the bulkhead beside the right-hand door, Balam ran his fingers over the metal. A shutter opened, revealing a 2x2-foot square made up of crystal points throbbing and pulsing with multi-hued light. Like a drawer, the board containing the colored tiles popped out. Immediately, Balam began manipulating the little squares, deftly sliding them from one position to another. The lights changed color, shifted through different spectra.
Reactivating the jamming field apparently was the limit of the Overlord's interference with Enki. The hangar deck operational systems are still open. We can depart at any time.
Grant and Bridget raised questioning eyebrows at each other. Grant wiggled his fingers and winced with pain.
I think it'd be best to wait for Kane.
Those were not his instructions.
He's not the boss of us.
I understand, but it might be a very unwise tactic to wait for him indefinitely. We should set a time limit for him to join us here.
And what if he doesn't make it by then?
Balam blinked but said nothing.
If he's not back here in, say, 15 minutes, then you and Balam can fly back to Cerberus.
What will you do?
Go and find him and bring him back. What else?
Why am I not surprised?
Enlil's astounded eyes darted from the shambles of the computer terminal to Kane's face. His lips worked, but no sound came forth. Kane guessed what he was trying to say.
Yeah, I know. I only bought me and my friend some time. There are plenty of other interfaces around this, Hulk. But this was the only one that had a direct link to Enki. Without it, you'll have to hunt and peck looking for him through all those data streams, all those digital impulses, and all those confusing neural networks. By the time you find him, we'll have forced you to live up to your end of the bargain.
He started to step past Enlil, but the consternation in the Overlord's eyes was instantly replaced by fury.
No!
He reached out to push Kane back, and Kane slapped his hand away as hard as he could. A pair of rings flew from his fingers, clinking to the catwalk.
Get out of my way. I may not have been able to kill you as either Thrush or Sam, but if you don't step aside, I'll be scraping you off the bottom of my boot in about 5 minutes.
Enlil didn't reply in words. He took a long step backward, moving his arms in slow, sweeping arcs in accordance with an arcane school of martial arts. Kane assumed that the Overlord expected the primitive growl to make him pause. Instead, he leaped to the attack, falling forward to deliver a swift roundhouse kick to his belly. He let the momentum carry him all the way around to drive a stab kick at the back of Enlil's right knee. Enlil's leg buckled, but he didn't fall. He staggered, caught himself on the top rail, and whirled to face his black-clad opponent, his eyes bright with kill lust. Kane assumed a combat posture, reservoirs of adrenaline pumping through his system. In a deliberately theatrical, challenging move, he swept his arms up and around, locking them in positions diagonal to his torso. Allowing a cold, taunting smile to play over his face, he beckoned Enlil with a forefinger.
Here endeth your reign, Sammy.
Enlil bounded toward him, swinging his clawed hands in strange, intricate, crisscrossing motions. Cain backed away from a slashing right hand, ducked to the left, and leaped forward, throwing his fists in a 1-2 jab at Enlil's face with every ounce of his weight behind them. Enlil evaded both punches with lightning-swift moves of his head. He swung his left hand viciously in return, fingers bent into hooks. His claws struck Cain across the ribs, and the impact numbed his left side. If not for the shadow suit, he had no doubt the raking blow would have disemboweled him. For a long moment, they stood toe-to-toe and exchanged a flurry of blows and blocks. Cain landed a wicked uppercut, but then took a punishing right hook to the belly. He nearly doubled over as streaks of pain lanced through his solar plexus, but he managed to shift aside and stay upright. He estimated that Enlil's strength was at least twice his own. His expression had to have betrayed that realization to Enlil. Enlil closed in. Cain stood his ground and pumped both fists into Enlil's face in short pistoning motions. The Overlord staggered, blood springing from his lips, but he didn't fall. He lunged forward again, long arms swinging wide. Cain used his left forearm to shunt aside a clawed hand driving toward his face. Following through, he delivered a backhanded ram's head jab between Enlil's eyes. It was like backhanding a statue. Pain flared in his wrist halfway up to his elbow. Enlil stumbled back a pace, glaring at Cain with a combination of rage and disbelief. Then he charged forward, sweeping Cain up in a vicious embrace. Cain tried to fight his way out of the hug, knowing close quarters would be fatal. He wasn't able to deflect Enlil's arms. Close locked, Cain and Enlil wrestled and struggled, staggering on hard-braced legs, slamming against the metal wall of the ziggurat. Purple silk sleeves ripped. Enlil's arms encircled Cain's body and they tightened across his spine. He heard the creaking of cartilage.
Do you know what that sound signifies to me, Cain? It is the sound of your kind's extinction. A tiny whimper of resignation, not a roar of defiance.
Enlil cinched down tighter, and Cain knew his adversary's greater strength could break his back like latticework. Instead of trying to fight his way out of the hug, Cain drove the crown of his head against Enlil's chin. His jaws closed with a clack. Cain butted him again, this time flattening his nose. The Overlord's head snapped back, the luster of his scales dimmed by a splattering of blood. Enlil flung Cain away from him. He fell heavily, the impact with the catwalk nearly driving all the air from his lungs. He rose as quickly as he could, a sick dizziness assailing him. Enlil uncoiled into a spinning back fist, pivoting from the waist, arms at full extension. Before Cain could move, the ring-weighted blow exploded against the right side of his jaw. Agony threaded through his consciousness. Instinctively, he turned with the punch, then dropped down to the floor to avoid his opponent's other hand. He swept Enlil's feet out from under him with a leg scythe. His side and lower back felt as if they were on fire, taking his breath away, but he forced himself to his feet, achieving a standing posture before Enlil got to his knees. Cain launched a front stab kick that caught Enlil in the chest. Enlil nearly went down again, but then set his knees and feet and sprang forward, his clawed hands whipping around in a blur. Staying loose, bouncing on the balls of his feet, his breath ragged in his own ears, Cain danced away from the ivory talons slashing by his face, missing his eyes by a scant fraction of an inch. Perspiration beaded on his forehead. Enlil brought his left hand down in a vicious overhand loop. Cain sidestepped, using all of his mag skills and experience to avoid the Overlord's punch. Enlil stumbled, off balance from the force of his unconnected blow. Instantly, Cain leaned back in, closing his hand around Enlil's left wrist. He slipped his forearm in front of Enlil's wrist, concentrating on keeping his opponent's limb locked down. He brought a knee up and slammed Enlil in the groin, having no idea if striking him in such an area would inflict any damage. Enlil's reaction, if any, was minimal. Enlil twisted in Cain's grip, and with his free arm, Cain pounded three elbow strikes against the Overlord's side and stomach. As Enlil continued twisting, the strange spiny growths from his shoulder ripped through the silk tabard, slashing at Cain's face. He released the arm lock, but the tip of a spine sliced the thin, shallow furrow along his right temple. Cain felt the flow of blood running down the side of his face and his neck. Putting his back to the metal rail of the catwalk, he watched Enlil approach him slowly, wiping the scarlet spatters from his face with the back of one hand. Enlil bared red-filmed teeth in either a grin or a grimace. It was impossible to tell.
Even if you escaped Yamat, you will not escape me. I will still come down to your stronghold and take my mate.
You can try. We won't treat invaders mercifully.
You dare speak of invasion? You have invaded the holiest of holies, the most revered artifact of my race, and use her like a pawn in a cheap gambit. I will not forget this blasphemy, Cain. Nor shall she.
Cain met Enlil's gaze unblinkingly. Then he feinted toward him, turned, and raced up to the uppermost level. When he reached the very top, he realized he had made a serious mistake. He had run himself into a trap, a cul-de-sac. There was no way up or down except along the same stairway, and Enlil was now climbing it, both hands on the rails. Cain looked up at the array of lights on the ceiling, attached to a complicated framework. They were too high to reach. He took a deep breath, crouched, and set himself, eyes fixed on the head of the stairs. He strained his ears, listening to the tramping sounds of Enlil's steady ascent. When his head and shoulders appeared, Cain sank in almost a prone position, balancing himself on the ball of his right foot and the flat of his left hand. Enlil's torso rose, and Cain launched himself into a spinning Tobigeri flying kick. As he whirled, he slammed Enlil on the side of his head with his extended left foot and smashed his right heel into his jaw. Enlil tottered on the riser, arms windmilling wildly. His left hand desperately closed around Cain's right ankle as he toppled backward. He hung on to him as he crashed down the stairs. Together, they tumbled headlong down the stairway, locked in each other's arms, tearing at each other. The brain-jarring impacts of hitting the risers caused Cain's surroundings to wink out for an instant. Cain struck the floor grill on his left shoulder, and he bounced toward the edge of the tier. Dazed, he tried to ignore the knives of pain stabbing through him as he hauled himself to his feet by the guardrail. Enlil, bleeding from a laceration on his scalp, bounded at him in a smashing attack, bending him back over the rail. His teeth gleamed in a maniacal grin, and he sank steely fingers into the muscles of Cain's throat. Only the high collar of his shadow suit kept Enlil's sharp nails from puncturing the flesh beneath. Cain hit him with all the strength he could muster, connecting with the heel of his left hand under his chin. Although Enlil's head snapped back amid a spray of crimson droplets, he only bore down on the stranglehold. His hands cinched tighter around Cain's throat, cutting off his ability to breathe, to think. Enlil's face tilted crazily above him, swimming off into a blurry fog at the edges. Distantly, with a rather detached sense of horror, he heard the strange, dry sound of his own cracking vertebrae. Fighting for air, Cain raised both hands above his head, clasping them together. Pivoting violently to the left from the waist, he used the well-developed wing muscle at the base of his shoulder socket as a fulcrum, prying away Enlil's stranglehold. The Overlord's hands lost their grip, and Cain lashed out with his leg, a blind flailing rather than a well-aimed or timed kick. Enlil rushed him. Clutching the rail with both hands, Cain kicked himself off the platform and closed his legs around Enlil's waist in a scissor lock. Tightening his body like a bowstring, he allowed the momentum of the Overlord's attack to lever him up and over. Enlil felt himself anchored at the waist by lithe legs. Cain back-somersaulted over the rail, his hands maintaining their grasp. However, he relaxed his legs' grip around the Overlord. Enlil plummeted straight down to the deck 50-plus feet below, the sleeves of his tabard flapping like wings. Still dangling from the rail, shoulder sockets burning with a deep, piercing pain as they supported all of his weight, Cain twisted around and looked down past his feet. Enlil lay sprawled out, motionless, near the base of a black pylon. Even as he stared, Cain saw a dark red puddle edging out from beneath his body. Clenching his teeth, Cain hauled himself back up to the tier, a fine sheen of moisture dampening his body, mixing with the blood trickling from the claw-inflicted wound on his temple. He felt justified in taking a moment to catch his breath and take stock of himself. His arms and legs ached, and his ribcage felt sore and bruised. As he started down the stairs, a sharp pain drove its hot knife into his right thigh, letting him know he had torn or strained a ligament somewhere.
Shit!
He had gotten off lucky, though. Or so he tried to tell himself as he used both metal banisters for support. By the time he had reached the foot of the stairs, Kane leaned against only one of the rails. He hobbled among the pylons, making his way over to Enlil's body. When he couldn't find it, he at first hoped he had made a mistake as to where it was positioned. That hope lasted for less than 20 seconds. He came across a fresh smear of blood glistening on the deck, but no sign of Enlil. Kane put his back to one of the black pillars.
Why am I not surprised?
After a long moment of gathering his strength and massaging his sore muscles, he pushed himself away from the pylon, hobbling in the direction of the elevator. He had only gone a dozen steps when the gold-armored Nephilim, Enlil's personal attendant, stepped out from behind a pillar to block his way. Kane stared into the man's white, blank eyes.
Get the fuck out of my way!
To his surprise, the Nephilim did just that. Most of the people who lived in the Cerberus Redoubt acted in the capacity of support personnel, regardless of their specialized individual skills or training. They worked rotating shifts, 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. Primarily, their work was the routine maintenance and monitoring of the installation's environmental systems, the satellite data feed, and the security network. One of the infrequent tasks that did not fall onto the shoulders of any one person was grave digging. Although Farrell had been pressed into service more than once to fabricate gravestones in the redoubt's workshop. Wegman leaned on the handle of his shovel and looked at the row of headstones at the foot of the slope bordering the plateau. The small white cubes bore only engraved last names: Cotta, Rauch, Adrian, Davis, and seven others. There were no other inscriptions, no birth or death dates on the austere markers. Wegman wondered idly if Farrell would have to fashion the headstones for Kane, Bridget, and Grant before too much longer. If so, he would not volunteer to dig their graves. He glanced up into the leaden mid-morning sky. The wind, which had been gusting around the mountain peak for the past hour, had grown progressively colder. Indian summer felt as if it had come to a decisive end, and the overcast day was a perfect backdrop to his task. A balding, sharp-featured, slightly built man under medium height, Wegman served as the Cerberus Redoubt's engineer, tending to the nuclear generators and the reactor buried deep within the stony bosom of the mountain. This day he had volunteered for the grave-digging duty for reasons that were murky, even to him. Suddenly, at the far edge of audibility, he heard a faint, keening whine. Looking up, he scanned the overcast sky as the whines grew in volume. The familiar winged outlines of two of the Manta Tavs appeared overhead. Engaging the vectored thrust ramjets, the Mantas dropped straight down and gracefully came to rest on the extended landing gear, on either side of the other pair of ships covered by camouflage netting. Fine clouds of dust puffed up all around, and Wegman squinted away from the grit, shielding his eyes. When the throb of the engine cycled down, he looked toward the craft again. The canopies were opaque, so it was impossible to see who sat within the cockpits. The canopy of the Manta nearest him popped open and slid back. Silently, he watched Kane heave himself out of the pilot's seat and stand on the wing. He extended a hand into the cockpit, and when the sunset hue of Bridget Baptiste's hair came into view, Wegman experienced a wave of relief so intense his knees went momentarily weak. His relief wasn't quite as pronounced when he saw Grant and Balaam climb out of the second Manta. He had nothing against Grant, since the big man had always treated him cordially, but the sight of the big-headed, big-eyed Balaam still gave him the shivers. Wegman didn't show his apprehension of the Archon. He continued to lean on the shovel as the four figures approached. He took note of the dried blood streaking the right side of Kane's face and how he walked stiffly, as if his legs pained him. The others appeared to be uninjured, but they didn't seem very happy to be back at Cerberus either. When they caught sight of him standing at the bottom of the half-dug grave, all of their faces registered emotion of differing degrees. Wegman fancied that even Balaam's face twitched in reaction. Kane stared at the head of the gravesite.
When?
Around daybreak.
And the baby?
She gave birth to a little girl. As far as I know, she was born perfectly healthy. Domi is looking after her. Quavel. She was always nice to me. I liked her. Respected her.
We know. She felt the same way about you.
Wegman plunged the shovel blade into the ground.
DeForest said she died of eclampsia. But I think she only said that for our benefit. Maybe hers, too. I don't think she really knows what killed her.
You may want to put that off for a bit. We're expecting company.
Wegman affected not to have heard him, levering up a shovelful of loose earth and dumping it on the pile to his left.
When they come, they're not coming for us. They're coming for Quavell's baby.
Who is?
We're convening a redoubt-wide briefing. We'll explain then.
Fetch me then.
Bridget reached down and laid a hand on the back of his head, where his gray-threaded brown hair was tied back in a knot.
We're calling it now. We don't have much time to prepare. As hard-hearted as this sounds, if we don't make ready as soon as possible, then you'll find yourself digging a lot more graves.
Wegman paused, pondering, not looking at her. He shot an inquisitive glance at Bridget, then over at Kane and Grant. They met his gaze sympathetically. None of them took his misanthropic tendencies seriously, not since he had risked his own life to save theirs from Beth Lee's machinations. Bridget extended her hand down to him.
God damn it all.
Wegman jammed the blade of the shovel into the loose dirt and took Bridget's hand.
I'm getting blisters anyway.